Episode 33, January the 27th, 2010. Ptolemy's Almagest. Hello and welcome to AstroTalk UK. ATUK is a not-for-profit amateur astronomy podcast produced by me, Gurbir Singh, an amateur astronomer based in the UK. For more information, see the About and FAQ pages at www.astrotalkuk.org.
Tas menen ton parayon paritena po fansing tu to you to defionias kai aporias matoimenan.
Words of Ptolemy, written almost 2,000 years ago, read in the original ancient Greek by Professor Malcolm Heath at the University of Leeds. If you had the task of gathering all of humanity's knowledge of cosmology in one place, how would you do it? Answers to questions such as, how big is the Earth? What date and time will the moon be full again? What makes the sun shine? How old is the universe? Today, a good place to start the project would be to scour the sources online. In about 150 AD, Claudius Ptolemaeus, better known as Ptolemy, a Greek national with Roman citizenship living in Egypt, attempted to do just that. He is best known for his encyclopedic work written in ancient Greek, Syntaxis Mathematica, perhaps better known as the Almagest from the Arabic Al-Magesti, the greatest. He was an industrious author of many scientific and mathematical treatises, but he also collected work going back hundreds of years. The Almagest was the premier source of knowledge for describing the cosmos for almost 2,000 years. Nothing of the original survives, only handwritten copies of handwritten copies. Today's episode is partially about one such copy, a 700-year-old manuscript rediscovered recently in the special collections of the Brotherton Library in the University of Leeds. This episode is also about how information is transmitted through history, the value that successive individuals, societies and civilizations put on them, the inevitable errors in the mishmash of translations over hundreds of years from one language, ancient Greek, Syriac, Arabic, Latin, English, to another, or the periodic attempts by one scribe to diligently copy the work of another. In early 2009, Dr. Regina Mai and Professor Malcolm Heath, Department of Classics, University of Leeds, came across a 14th century manuscript catalogued as a work of astrology and discovered it contained elements of Ptolemy's Almagest. The manuscript, in three volumes, has yet to receive detailed scholarly scrutiny. In today's episode, there are four contributors. Dr. Oliver Pickering, keeper of the Special Collections, describing how the library acquired the manuscript in the first place. A live recording of Professor Malcolm Heath and Dr. Alan Chapman inspecting the manuscript in the Brotherton Library. But first, Dr. Regina Mai outlines how the almost accidental discovery of this manuscript came about.
Since the Brotherton Library in Leeds has a very good and well-known collection of manuscripts and even older material like papyri, Professor Heath and I entered into a collaboration with Dr. Pickering, who was the keeper of ancient manuscripts. When we went through the list of manuscripts available in the library, we came across this mysterious title, Codex Astrologicus in the Catalogue.
That's in Latin.
The title is in Latin because the catalogue was written in Latin, but the manuscript turns out to be in Greek.
What makes a manuscript?
Manuscript literally means written by hand. So by definition, everything before the invention of the printing press in 1450 is a manuscript. We're able to see on first inspection that it certainly contained pieces of Ptolemy's Almagest. So the catalogue entry was somewhat misleading by saying it was astrological. We did find out, when especially Professor Heath looked at it in more detail, that it had been used before by editors of the text of Ptolemy and other less important astronomers of late antiquity. There's also some material in that codex which is not yet properly edited. So that's actually something that I come across time and again when I look at a Greek or a Latin manuscript. There's always something intriguing. There's always something we haven't known or thought of before. There's always something new to discover. And this manuscript here is no exception. That is, I think, what makes classics such an exciting and unusual discipline to work in.
So this text, this manuscript, it's in ancient Greek.
Yes.
Is it fair to say ancient Greek in the past had the same status of international language for, amongst other things, science, that Latin once had and English has today?
This is quite a difficult question. The manuscript, of course, is written in ancient Greek, which was, of course, the language of Ptolemy. He was the greatest astronomer of the 2nd century AD, possibly in Alexandria. And at that time, Alexandria was one of the greatest centres of learning in the ancient world. And there are, from that time, several scientific treatises still around in Latin. But especially in the eastern part of the Roman Empire, Greece, but also Alexandria, it was Greek that dominated sciences, but also literature. Eventually, in the Middle Ages, Latin, however, took over in the Western world as the scientific language par excellence. Slowly, in our part of the world, the knowledge of Greek was lost until 15th century again, when Greek scholars came back from Byzantium to Italy, Byzantium, what is now Istanbul. And only then the Greek language became known again in the Western world.
So there was a period, maybe about 400-500 years after the end of the Roman Empire, when ancient Greek was pretty much lost.
Well, lost to the Western world, but it still continued to be spoken in Byzantium until it was conquered, of course, by the Arabs. The Arabic rulers, especially in Baghdad, were extremely interested in ancient philosophy and sciences. It is primarily thanks to their efforts that some ancient Greek texts were preserved, in addition to the ones kept available in Greece itself. Ptolemy, for example, was translated into ancient Syriac and then into Arabic from about 450 AD onwards. There was much science translated into Syriac. There are quite a few medical texts, for example, which we only have because they were translated into Syriac. So there are texts when we don't have the Greek original anymore, but we have Syriac translations of these texts.
The title of the manuscript, Codex Astrologicus, was probably the reason why it had not been correctly identified as Ptolemy's work. What does the title mean?
Well, codex means it is bound as a book as opposed to as papyrus scrolls. So codex just means block, so it is shaped as a book. Astrologicus, of course, means astrological. But it turned out on closer inspection that the manuscript is a compendium of several works of both astronomical and astrological nature. It comes in three volumes, and volume one has excerpts from Ptolemy, but volume two has hitherto, or so it seems, unpublished texts on astronomy, which may be of some interest to scholars. And the catalogue entry, the Codex Astrologicus entry, homes in surprisingly on the latter parts of the manuscript, which are astrological rather than astronomical. I should also perhaps say that although we see Ptolemy as the father of astronomy in many ways, he also has written a book called the Tetrabiblos, and that is also a compendium on astrology. So even he was not distinguishing clearly between astronomy and astrology.
Dr. Regina Mai, thank you very much indeed. Dr. Oliver Pickering, how did the manuscript find its way here to the University of Leeds?
The manuscript seems to be known by a man called Anthony Askew, who was a prominent book collector in the 18th century. built up one of the most famous libraries of classical literature at the time, which was dispersed, sold after his death. He certainly travelled in Italy as part of the Grand Tour during probably the 1740s, and it's likely that he acquired this manuscript there, though that's speculation. Whether he got as far as the East in the sense of Byzantium, I don't know, but he probably got it in Italy, brought it home, and it added, was added to his huge, huge library of classical works, sold after his death. It was then apparently owned by a man called Joseph Wyndham, who was another antiquary specializing in Italy and possibly Greece. What happened to the manuscript after that, I don't know, but it eventually entered Lord Brotherton's collection in the 1920s, and Brotherton bequeathed his library to the University of Leeds. It's been here since 1936.
Thank you. The manuscript is here in front of us. Dr. Alan Chapman is also present. Professor Heath, I know you've not had a great deal of time to examine the manuscript. What are your initial findings?
This is actually quite a complex set of documents. Volume 1 begins with extracts from Ptolemy's Megale Syntaxis, what's known as the Almagest, and contains two shorter works by Ptolemy. But it also has extracts from the 4th century Greek commentary on the Almagest by Theon of Alexandria. Yeah. I haven't analysed the whole thing, but this is extracts from Ptolemy and supporting materials. Very sophisticated working out of a geocentric cosmology.
And also, too, is an encyclopedia, because he draws together figures who've known works who've gone. So figures, let's say, in people like Anaximenes and people like that, whose works are not known and haven't survived, were either around in 180 AD, or at least were known in 180 AD. Also, another thing he does, too, which is important, he uses the 360-degree scale, which, of course, we know was used by the Greeks, was used by Hipparchus, which is 300 years before him, actually not become in general full use until about 150 BC. Okay, so Ptolemy describes instruments such as the armillary sphere, the astrolabium, which is the ancestor of the astrolabe, and things of this sort. One might question how far it's an original work. How far is the Encyclopaedia Britannica an original work? It's a bit like that. It's a state-of-the-art commentary on Greek astronomy, as it was understood in 150 AD. So that, in a way, is...
And it's the most comprehensive written.
It's the most, and it's this which sends Greek astronomy into the next 1,500 years, until Copernicus, who of course knows it like the back of his hand, but it is a tremendous compilation. Of course, literally, Magnaeosyntaxis, the great bringing together. And of course, when the Arabs called it Almagestion, which means effectively the same thing, the Great Digest.
The Magisti Syntaxis, the huge compilation.
Even Chaucer, I remind my students in Oxford, in the Miller's Tale, introduces a character, Master Nicholas, who is, of course, the characteristic scapegrace, bilingual student, and all the rest of it. And he describes what Master Nicholas possesses. He says he has an astrolabium and Ptolemy his Almagestion.
So, I mean, it's widely circulated then. There are a lot of
massively, massively.
Left, you think, from the Middle Ages of...
The earliest two 9th century Greek manuscripts survive. In Western Europe, the only direct knowledge of Ptolemy was through a Latin translation made in the 12th century, and that was actually the first version of Ptolemy that was printed in 1515, was that Latin translation, and the Greek text was printed in 1536, I think.
So this manuscript is dated very early 14th century, 1305. Where would this have been produced?
Well, there's no internal evidence. There are no scribal signature. The chapters of Ptolemy that I've identified, one is on the length of the solar year, and three are on observations of the moon and the phases of the moon.
Are there diagrams?
Yeah, there are lots of wonderful diagrams in there, yes. The second volume seems to be a complete treatise on astronomy in 34 chapters, following, as far as I can see, a Ptolemaic approach. And the last chapter is how to determine the date of Easter in accordance with ecclesiastical rules.
Commonly needed thing,
yes. Okay, that might help.
Now, that explains, I think, the selection of chapters from Ptolemy.
Yes.
Because Easter depends on a lunisolar year, so you need to know the length of the solar year and about the moon.
Right.
So my guess would be that this comes from an ecclesiastical context.
Would it, does it mention Bede, the Venerable Bede? Because his method of calculating the date of Easter in the Computatus about 730 became widespread across Europe.
Right, I doubt it would be known in the East, though.
Yes, may not have been known. It was certainly known across Europe.
Yeah, the Greek manuscripts only began to circulate in the West in the 15th century.
Yes.
So I think we're looking at a compilation made perhaps in a monastery.
Yes.
There are several different people involved in making this manuscript. The handwriting changes. And it has a practical ecclesiastical use.
Yeah. There are a lot of entries on the sides by presumably readers or users of this manual. Does that, I don't know if you had a chance
to... Well, some of them are simply chapter numbers.
Oh, I see.
For example, that's the Greek numeral for 34.
Right.
But there are elsewhere very short annotations in the margin. In the first volume, in Ptolemy, there are actually longer notes,
yes,
which are clearly copied out of the previous copy.
Yes.
But here you've got the reader or user making notes in the margin. I can't read this. The writing is too heavily abbreviated, but there are astronomical symbols in there. So it's clearly an informed reader.
It looks like a crescent moon.
That's right. Yeah. So this is an informed reader making an explanatory note for his own use.
And that, although it's abbreviated, would be in ancient Greek as well.
It is in ancient Greek or medieval Greek.
This whole treatise is a complete in itself, you say.
As far as I can see, it seems to have...
Of course, calculating the date of Easter was crucial because it was essential to celebrate it, at least in theory, in the same city, on the same day in every city in Europe.
I think you've hadn't a great deal of time to look at this. The Almagest is what we thought it was initially. Certainly big chunks of it. Is the whole of the Almagest in its entirety there?
Or? No, the Almagest, as the name suggests, is huge. Right. 13 books. In the 2nd century, books were written on long lengths of papyrus, which were rolled up to make a scroll.
Mm-hmm.
And an average papyrus roll might be 30, 32 feet in length. So it means that Ptolemy's work took up 13 of those rolls.
Wow. Yes. That was the paperback edition.
In the centuries after Ptolemy, the structure of the book changed so that you had something more like a modern book with pages bound at one edge of the codex. That was one important transition. Another, in the 9th century, when we have our earliest Ptolemy manuscripts, people switched from writing formal text out in capitals to using a cursive form of handwriting, which takes up less space.
Right.
So it reduces your material costs, and you can do it more quickly, so it reduces your labour costs. And interestingly, of the two 9th century manuscripts, one falls on the capitals side of the divide, the other falls on the cursive handwriting side.
Was the original work in Ptolemy's hand on papyrus, would it have also been in similar script as we have in front of us?
No, that would have been written out in capitals.
In capitals.
Yeah. So it would have had a very different appearance.
Yes, but it's still ancient Greek.
Still ancient Greek.
The handwriting changes particularly
in volume three. Yeah. It does also change in volume two, though.
Does it? It's very noticeable then.
Now, the third volume is interesting. That's the one that was analysed, and the reason it was this has been analysed separately is that it's all on astrology.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a collection, it's very typical of Byzantine scholarship, that it's a collection of useful extracts from all sorts of sources, most of them anonymous.
Yeah.
Now, we might think that astrology and the church is a strange combination, and for a long time both the Roman political authorities and the ecclesiastical authorities were really hostile to astrology. But in the 9th century, when there was a revival of classical learning in Byzantium, astrology didn't cease to be controversial, but it came more respectable.
You were suggesting this was produced in a monastery.
I think so. This is a date after the revival of classical learning, when astrology had become more respectable.
I suppose if they didn't get into monasteries and places of worship like that, it's less likelihood that they would have survived.
And the monasteries or cathedral chapter libraries and places of this.
On the other hand, it is a depressing fact that of the surviving Greek manuscripts, the huge majority are Christian texts and sermons and prayer books. You may have heard of the Archimedes Codex, where parts of lost works of Archimedes have been recovered. This is what's known as a palimpsest, where a text has been rubbed out and a new text written over it. It's the Archimedes that was rubbed out and a prayer book written over it.
Would that have been in part because paper or material to write on was so
expensive? Yes.
And then, of course, the vellum you could easily scrape off and then rewrite on it again, which is modern techniques, of which you can enhance what's been described in the palimpsest.
Now, another combination that may seem strange is astronomy and astrology. So Ptolemy is a great astronomer, but of course he also wrote on astrology.
They saw the two coming together, because of course in the ancient world, I mean, there is not, in certainly in the Latin tradition, there's not a distinction between astronomer and astrologer. It's astrologi. And of course you have in the Vulgate the three wise men, the astrologi, who are utterly, they did the same thing. But I mean, after all, even Tycho Brahe was required to do horoscopes for the King of Denmark and didn't object to it.
And it's amazing how resilient astrology is. There's so much that's driven by the stars.
And some of the Renaissance Italian universities taught astrology as part of the quadrant, as adjunct to astronomy.
So even today, if you look what's in the papers, virtually every newspaper has a column on astrology. Very seldom on astronomy. Oliver, you're saying this from about the 14th century. How old is the oldest extant copy of the Almagest?
That's from the 9th century.
In Greek.
And is there much of Ptolemy's work from his own time in existence now?
No, because ancient literature has gone through these transformations from roll to codex and from capitals to cursive handwriting. Very, very few manuscripts survive from before the 9th century of any author.
And I suppose also it's done a geographical journey from the east towards the west and from back a few times.
See, some of the connections would have gone through people, not just from Ptolemy, actually pre-Ptolemy, but some of the concepts in Ptolemy, through people like Vitruvius, the Roman engineering writer, Pliny, who takes not merely the engineering of the ancient world, but I mean Vitruvius's treatise on architecture, 10 books on architecture, chapter 1 is about cosmology. In fact, both Pliny and Vitruvius start off by describing Eratosthenes' measurements of the size of the Earth using shadows.
Wow.
The 4,000, the 8,000 stadia.
It's context for you.
And of course, this is a compilation as well.
So you've got really multiple streams. You've got in the 8th and 9th century, Ptolemy was translated from Greek first into Syriac, which was the common language of the Middle East, and then several times into Arabic. Hence, the Latin translation in the 12th century was from an Arabic translation, from the Greek, because Greek wasn't known in Western Europe in the Middle Ages. So it's only in the 14th, 15th century that you begin to get knowledge of Greek, and with it Greek manuscripts flowing into the Western world from the Greek-speaking East.
Where you would have had a Greek manuscript into Syriac, Syriac into Arabic, then in Spain, Arabic into Latin, after the fall of Toledo in 1085.
And this is in ancient Greek. Is there a section you could read for us?
Okay. Let me I should say that the pronunciation of ancient Greek is quite difficult to reconstruct, and it changed over time, but I will do my best.
It's a pity you don't have an obvious Yorkshire accent. They said Ptolemy could have been a Yorkshireman, but no, it would be wonderful if you can.
Now, Annan mentioned earlier Hipparchus, one of Ptolemy's predecessors, and the passage here is talking about worries that Hipparchus had about variations in the length of the solar year, and Ptolemy is reassuring him that these are actually errors in his observations. And you raise the question of what was original in Ptolemy. He does introduce his own variations. Protu de panton ton periton helion apodegnumenon huparchontos tuton eniausion chronon herein tasmenon ton palaion periten apophansin tutoiutu defionias kai aporias matoimenan ecton suntatagmenon autois kai malister to hipparchi andri philoponoi te homu kai philalethe. So there he's giving a testimony to Hipparchus as a man who's very industrious, philoponos, and also a lover of truth. And he will go on to explain that Hipparchus had these worries about the apparent variation in the length of the solar year, but Ptolemy's own observations show that actually there's nothing to worry about. All the variations in those observations are explicable by errors in the instruments he used.
You then have Tycho Brahe taking up Ptolemy by pointing out that Ptolemy's tricutum, his three rulers, actually would have had such big errors in them that it was compared to his own observations being made in Denmark in 1580, even Ptolemy was miles off. And the thing is, of course, the heavens are really perfect. It's just the observations which are defective.
So although Ptolemy used his own observations, but he must have...
Oh, inherited a lot from Hipparchus. Yes. Tons from Hipparchus he draws in, yes. Mm.
So in a sense, his work, the Almagest, was based on observational evidence.
Yes. It's not a theoretics book. It's not actually just drawing in theories. It's rooted in geometry.
That model of Ptolemy's solar system was in place for about 1,500 years.
Oh, more than that. It was already old. I mean, the geocentric cosmos in the proper sense, you've probably got to Pythagoras, 500-something BC.
I guess the revolution of Copernicus, Tycho, Kepler was the point when it changed.
That's when you shift the centre. I think the great first great thing that happened in the Greek world is when they realise, probably because of travel, that the world is not flat. They come to get that by circa 600 BC. Mm-hmm. And they come to realise that, let's say, if you see the same eclipse in Spain, Athens and the Black Sea, it will be at different parts of the natural day, suggesting a curve.
But the evidence for putting the sun at the centre rather than Ptolemy's Earth at the centre was pretty much, well, the instrumentation that Tycho, Copernicus and Kepler were using was pretty much the same.
Just more accurate.
It's more accurate.
More accurate.
So it's just the accuracy of the observations and the... Was it a change in the shift, the way we think, the paradigm shift, if you like?
In a way, but on the other hand, you see, Copernicus, who's a deeply, deeply conservative figure, in the preface to De Revolutionibus in 1543, he says, I am not being innovative here. These are the Greeks that thought the Earth was, that the sun was in the centre of the universe.
And already in the 4th century BC, there were people who were thinking along those lines, because Aristotle has to argue against the heliocentric model, and his argument is that if the Earth orbited the sun, you would expect to observe stellar parallax.
Absolutely.
And you don't.
But Galileo says the same thing.
Mm-hmm. But the evidence that Galileo with his telescope was able to produce was irrefutable. It's very...
No, Galileo can't prove anything. Well, that's when he gets into trouble.
On the basis...
He's making assertions and pretending he can prove things.
But on the basis that he could see the phases of Venus, he could see and prove that it was between the Earth and the sun.
So could Tycho Brahe, because Tycho's system was to put the Earth in the middle, to have the sun rotating around the Earth, and then to have all the planets rotating around the sun. So the whole thing, exactly the phases of Venus with the triconic system as well.
What was the profound shift that allowed us to think in different ways and shifted the sun in the centre? What happened?
I think change is a slow one.
Right.
It happens during the 17th century as more and more collateral evidence is brought in. And I would argue we can't prove the Earth rotates until 1728. James Bradley, in 1728, publishes a letter to the Royal Society, a letter to Dr. Halley, the Astronomer Royal, describing a newfound motion of the fixed stars. And this is the aberration. And he argues, when he has a long telescope, the zenith set to 12.5 foot long, pointing straight to the zenith, and he lies on his back and looks at the star Gamma Draconis, which passes straight overhead in the latitude of London, he expects if there's a parallax, it will actually have that motion. And he can't find that motion. The instrument isn't sensitive enough. But he finds a motion. And he's absolutely flummoxed. And the mutation, 1728 to 1748, are the first physical proof that the Earth moves.
Considerations of intellectual elegance. Because when Aristotle defended the geocentric model, he was working with contemporary, cutting-edge contemporary mathematical astronomy that had everything on concentric circles.
Mm-hmm. Right.
By the time of Hipparchus, and certainly Ptolemy, it's been realised that that won't work, that you have to have circles that are eccentric, or you have to have epicycles, mm-hmm. where things go round in circles on the circumference of another circle.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just getting very complicated and looks very arbitrary.
The one thing that made Greek astronomy possible was the realisation that you have truths in nature which are not tangible. Geometry, in other words. You know, things that relate to great truths which are not physically measurable. And the wider argument that you have this bifurcated universe where you have perfection beyond the moon, you have chaos below the moon to explain change and things like that. And how do you have those two brought together? So you're having to constantly wrestle with imperfections and see them as parts of a greater perfection. I think historians look at Copernicus too from a modern angle. You know, oh, well, he was a bold innovator, but didn't dare open his rubbish. You know, he's a deeply conservative Greek geometer. And he finds it somehow, it's not heretical in a religious sense, it's almost intellectually heretical for a modern to contradict 2,000 years of Greek astronomy.
And these are the intellectual baggage that we carry with us that prevents us taking these bold steps.
Absolutely. Of course, we have to worry about what are the bold steps. And what's the difference between a bold step and a suicidal leap?
They've obviously survived these three manuscripts for a long time. How valuable are they in terms of the intellectual content?
How many other copies exist?
Like, well, it's possible that the treatise in Book 2 is unique.
That's not being studied. It's not being compared with anything else.
Well, I've checked it in the TLG database, which is the largest online corpus of Greek texts, and it's certainly not anything represented in that. There are certainly texts which are unique, but there are also texts which would have been in multiple copies but haven't been published or identified.
Mm.
So one can't say whether this is unique or not. It's probably, if one took made the effort to transcribe it in detail and compared it with other texts, you would find that it was entirely derivative and added nothing to our knowledge. But I think even the fact that it exists is an interesting reflection on the impact of Ptolemy, the length of that impact. Remember, this manuscript in the 14th century is closer in date to us than it is to Ptolemy. So this is actually a modern work.
I'm looking at three volumes now, and it's almost falls into three sections, the way you describe it. So it was conceived as a whole, three-part whole of the time it was written, do you think?
Quite possibly. There are a lot of Byzantines really liked compendia and compilations, things that would
in the Latin West.
Yes. So bringing together useful extracts from lots of sources was a very common practice.
The thing is, I think we have to bear in mind that we, from our 21st century point of view, approach the past with a kind of in out of which to pull pearls. We forget their priority, which is much more, you know, I want to make sure that Easter is celebrated on the right day this year. I won't this year. I will pillage this text, and this text, and make sure it's and the monastery down the road has the same one.
Yeah, and we have that utility in our modern science and industry today. But it does give us an opportunity to see how, in the past, the human race has been looking at their world and trying to understand it, see what possible mistakes we're making right now.
I think where science changed profoundly is in the 17th century. It's the idea of brand new knowledge which comes in the 16th and 17th century. Mm-hmm. Things never known before. And I think my own pet theory is that the great voyages of discovery had a lot to do with this. The finding of new places unknown to the ancient world, unmentioned in Ptolemy or Strabo or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And my pet theory of the ship as a scientific instrument. Mm-hmm. If you think of a scientific instrument that shows you things you can't see without it,
mm-hmm.
you discover America, you come home, you tell your friends about it, they're imagining another ship. yet. Yeah. But that's the beginning of the kind of verification process. Mm-hmm. And what do they always say? Aha, this contradicts Aristotle, this contradicts Strabo, this contradicts Ptolemy, all the rest of it. And then you have the realization that somehow we moderns are romping ahead, and that the ancients, first of all, become scorned to some degree, and then they become revered as a sort of cultural capsule.
An intriguing journey through almost 2,000 years of human civilization. No doubt there is much more to be learned from this manuscript, especially Volume 2. So, if you have an interest in astronomy and knowledge of ancient Greek, or maybe know someone who does, see the links on astrotalkuk.org. But for now, a special thanks to Professor Malcolm Heath for that wonderful rendition of ancient Greek. My first experience of hearing a language that once dominated Europe and beyond. Also, thanks again to Dr. Regina Mai, Dr. Oliver Pickering, and of course, Dr. Alan Chapman from the University of Oxford for his expertise and familiar enthusiasm. Today's quote is from Friedrich Nietzsche, a German philosopher of the late 19th century who read and wrote about the ancient Greek culture. Perhaps it was the writings from ancient Greek civilization which led him to conclude, "The future influences the present just as much as the past."